Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Shrine of Remembrance. My name is Neil Sharkey. I'm the Exhibitions Curator here at the Shrine. I'd like to begin, first of all, by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which the Shrine is built, the Elders, both past and present. Before we begin today's presentation, let's take a moment to honour the service and sacrifice of Australian servicemen and women. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget.
Thank you. I am very pleased to welcome our guest speaker today, Patty Wright. Patty began her career as a producer and a director in the Australian film industry. Her interest in writing about ex-POWs began with a simple personal desire to learn more about Sir Edward Weary Dunlop and the prisoners of war who were enslaved on the Tyburma Railway during the Second World War. Patty became a published author and an expert on the subject of POWs, particularly those who were worked on the line. Over the last decade, her research into this history has involved well over 100 interviews in Australia, Britain and Japan with ex-POWs, as well as members of the Imperial Japanese Army who worked on the line. She travelled to the POW camps in Japan and along the Tyburma Railway. From these efforts came her first book, the highly acclaimed Men of the Line. In her exploration of Australian POW experiences, one particular man stood out, Ray Parkin. Patty's fascination with and respect for Ray led her to interview him many times, often with a film crew assisting in recording Ray's stories. The culmination of these conversations and many hundreds of hours of further research and writing is Ray Parkin's Odyssey, the first and full comprehensive record of the extraordinary life and times of this unique Australian. Patty is here today to provide us with an account of Ray. Would you please join me in welcoming Patty to the lectern?
Hello, everyone. I'll make sure that I've been heard. Thank you, Hayley. Is that better? Everyone got me? Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming, everybody. I hope you both enjoy and are informed by what I'm about to tell you about Ray Parkin today. As his history is rather large, I will jump a little bit in various parts. I will speak on aspects of Ray's life that interest me, and I just hope they do you as well. The emphasis of my talk today will be on CPO, Chief Petty Officer Ray Parkin, AMRAN. Ray, the seaman, the philosopher, the artist and author, naval historian and POW of the Japanese. Yes, it'll be on all of his history, I would hope, if I get through it, but also his talent. I will also try and tell you a little bit about the Ray I knew outside the history. It's a fairly large story, so we'll settle in, I hope. As well, I'm going to talk about seven other POWs, most of whom didn't know one another, and only one returned. And they all figure quite large in Ray's life. But most of all, they touched my heart. So I would like to not show you all of them, because I don't have pictures of all of them, but to tell you a little bit about them. But first to Ray. I met Ray in 2001, and there was no doubt from the very beginning that Ray was going to be a challenge. He was engaging, difficult, demanding, opinionated, crabby, standoffish and intimidating. He was also an utter gentleman. He loved a laugh and loved attention, but he was always as well a modest man, a reclusive man, whom Australia really should have known more about. Ray was set in his ways, that's for sure. Often he would be so fixated on what he thought about nature, which is near to his favourite subject, nature with a capital N, he always wrote it that way, or his thoughts on philosophy or religion and how he thought the world should work, that he left no space for any reply or counter-idea or objection. And I'm sure Jill, who's sitting over there now, is chuckling. Jill is his eldest child, and I think perhaps she might nod and agree with me. I hope so anyway. You really had no chance to make comment at times. So Some would say that Ray was even rude in how he dominated this type of conversation, and they might be right, but in general I found Ray Parkin, absolutely fascinating and welcoming, so I reckon I was pretty lucky to have met him. I'm mightily in awe of Ray and his talent, and should you read his biography, I hope you will appreciate that I wrote of him and those around him very honestly. This was no hagiography, but a sympathetic, clear-eyed portrait of a man I admired greatly. I owed him that. He would have expected it as well, and I needed to write about him from all sides, occasionally assisted by his own cutting words from his diary notations. His POW diaries were at times rather caustic of others. And to be fair, he would question himself in the same diaries. He was more demanding of himself than he was of others at times. Photographs of Ray my husband and I took when we went to film him, and I'm so really pleased that I did that, because we have the contemporary Ray, and you can see his hawk-like eyes are, you know, they're very intelligent eyes, but they're pretty intimidating eyes. Anyway, Ray would also retreat in his life to rearranging a life. When life fell out of what he thought it should be, he didn't just do this in his POW years, he did it right throughout his life. The order of life, the actual order of life in which life should progress, was, in his mind, brought about by hard work and good old-fashioned common sense and regard for others. So when the reality of the world became too threatening, and out of his control to control, Ray reordered things to survive. And it often worked for him. It really did. But he was a man who liked to have his way. He did this, not always for others though. He did this with his best mate, Alfie Coyne. And Alf, when he was dying slowly on the Tyburma Railway, he wasn't too accommodating of that, and I will speak about that later. He also did it with his much-loved wife, Thelma. One of the quotes that says a lot about Ray to me, in fact, I'll give you three quotes, but the first one is, "The first rule of life is to accept it." There's maybe a contradiction here, but Ray Parkin was contradiction. Another that has always made me laugh, given where Ray ended up in his life, is "sleep dry and eat twice a day." Or, and this could be his epitaph, "be frugal." Ray was all of these. He did earnestly live by his principles, much more than any other person I ever met. So to his history. Ray was born in Collingwood of working class parents, and joined the Navy the day after his 18th birthday in 1929. He was a painter and a writer from the very get-go. He taught himself how to draw and use watercolours, which were his preferred medium. He learnt to write by composing very long letters to his wife, Thelma, when he was away at sea. And Ray's spelling, dare I say, was always very suspect. At sea, in those early days, he read like the very devil. He was informing himself, always taking great piles of second-hand books aboard each voyage. And they weren't adventure novels. Ray read philosophy, science, history, religions. He read deeply, always. Ray was an autodidact. He was self-taught as he left school early, and he always painted wherever he was. In May 1939, Ray was deployed overseas as part of the commissioning crew of the new light cruiser HMAS Perth. A young crew had been assembled, a rather haphazard bunch, who were to sail to Portsmouth to collect and commission the ship and bring her home. In that photograph, I don't know where Ray can, anyway, doesn't matter, that's fine. he sailed to Portsmouth to collect and commission the ship and bring her home. For those familiar with the journey to England, you might recognise the ship they took, and this is Ray's watercolour of the SS Autolycus. She was an old freighter and stinking from the animals she'd just transported. I should say too, apart from, there's about 90% of all the images you see here today are all Ray's work. There's a few photographs, there's a couple of AWM photographs, but the rest of it is Ray Parkin. And you'll see he's broad, and I've got about 1,000 of his images, sketches, watercolours. It's an amazing archive, absolutely astonishing archive, and I can't tell you how pleased I am that he kept it and his family value it. Anyway, they were off on a very prestigious gig, this one, to go and get Perth, and they really called it Perth's World Cruise, which we'll see by this really rather funny postcard. All the boys knew that they were going to have a good time, and they did, kind of, because New York was the next stop. Perth was there as Australia's representative at the 1939 World Fair. Contextually, all was not as it should have been, however, as New York was where Perth's crew had their mutiny. Most of those involved preferred to call it an incident, but from my reading, it was a mutiny, and Ray called it that when we spoke of it, and surprisingly, he was on the side of the mutineers. The New York police even arrived, and it made front page news in the New York Times. It was a bit of a stink, really, but they managed. No one really got into that much trouble. It was planned that Perth would return to Australia via short stopovers in the Pacific, but with the war very, very close, it came as no surprise to most aboard when Captain Farncombe received their new orders for the Caribbean. When it came to a choice of station, Ray said they were lucky. It was near perfect. The gloriously exotic harbour of Kingston, Jamaica, and her people were their base, and the lads had a very good time. And here, Ray had the time to do a great deal of painting. This was the type of painting that he had always wanted to do. The people, the places, and the ships, and the seas, and the different hues to those that he'd been used to at home. Ray wrote an account of this time, thankfully for this biographer. He wrote so much, it was wonderful. So from leaving, he wrote one particular paper, from leaving on the Autolycus in 39 to Perth's noisy welcome home to Sydney in 1940. By this stage, Ray had held the rank of petty officer well before leaving to collect Perth. He was also Action Chief Quartermaster, or Captain of the Foretop, as he would say, and he was Perth's go-to helmsman, his action helmsman, her action helmsman. And his best mate was Alfie Coyne, this pirate-looking chap you can see now. I've got a great soft spot for Alfie. Alfie was a lad from Harcourt here in country Victoria, and he was captain of Y Turret, one of Perth's 4-inch guns. He was also one of Brace's boys, a.k.a. Lieutenant Warwick Brace Girdle, a much-loved then junior officer aboard Perth, and now rather a legend in the RAN. Alf is the first of the seven men I mentioned earlier. Ray, the intellectual, the reader, the artist, the writer. Alf was a country lad who had had a rough upbringing and few to love him at home. And they were very different, but they were very close. Alfie Boy was one who loved to tie one on, and whenever Ray was with him, he was the one who had to bring him back. Both Alf and Ray were 12-year men, and with only a few months left to serve when they were sent to commission Perth, they both thought they'd be back in good time. Both men would have left the Navy. Their families, both of their families have told me this, had there not been a war. But Ray and Alf were old hands, and they knew that they were needed, so they stayed. Alf's story ends in the jungles of Thailand as a shrunken and sick man. So I'm sure you understand why I wanted to mark Ray as much as I did in Ray's story, in his biography. The Mediterranean was next for Perth. Between December 1940 and July 1941, and it was utter hell. Starkly different to the Kingston station that they'd just served on in every way. Perth was to be under the command of the British as part of the 7th Cruiser Squadron. By then, Perth's second captain was aboard, an English baron, Sir Philip Boyer Smythe of the Royal Navy. They called him Old Boyang, but they loved him. And overall fleet command was in the very experienced hands of Admiral Sir Andrew Brown Cunningham, ABC as his men called him. Now he's on the very, ABC's on the very, without a hat on the very left of that photograph, which is a pretty extraordinary photograph when you see he's sitting in the front. Both of these men were sturdy, brilliant commanders and both highly respected by Ray. The boys were lucky. Even though Ray always kept his less than happy lower deck attitudes about officers all his life, Boyer, Smythe and Cunningham were the exceptions. Such was the regard for Cunningham that after the war, until the Admiral's death, Ray and Cunningham corresponded. Then Ray continued writing to Lady Cunningham until her death. Ray kept a file he entitled Correspondence with Three Admirals, and the admirals were Chalmers, Adams and Cunningham. And I really did like this file. It was terrific reading, and it just showed me how similar these men were. The story of Percy and the Med requires an address of its own. It really does. Such is the breadth and importance of this theatre of war. It was a bad time in the Med, and while Perth was there, we weren't winning. It was shocking. But sadly, I don't have time to go into it in detail. As an overview, Perth spent 7 months in the Med, taking part in the Battle of Matapan against the Italian fleet, which is, if you read it, such a sad, sad story about Italian loss at sea. Much of this makes you cry, but the Italians really did cop it in the Battle of Matapan. They were sitting ducks. There were the battles for Greece and Crete, and then the evacuations that followed. Operations against the Vichy French in Syria, Perth's near miss in Malta Harbour, convoys, and more convoys. Perth's battle honours for the Mediterranean are very impressive. Perth's refuelling was even fraught, and it was often done in Souda Bay in Crete. Ray's description tells us why. This is his quote. "Because of the surrounding hills, aircraft could be suddenly upon us without warning, so we quickly named it Suicide Bay." During Perth's time in the Med, she withstood 257 direct attacks. She was a lucky ship to have got through, and she was finally badly scarred, but she wasn't sunk. Perth and her crew were heroes in the real sense of the word. During this time, they survived the horror of the continual bombardments by German Stukas. So constant and savage were the attacks that an electrical artificer, Peter Murdoch, left his action station in the forward boiler room, climbed up on deck at night and jumped over the side. He committed suicide rather than endure the repeated bombardments, the fear, the noise, the heat, and more fear. And Peter wasn't a young recruit, he was an experienced sailor. But he'd reached his limit. His divisional officer was Braces, Lieutenant Brace Girdle. And he never forgot what happened, of course, and he altered how he and other officers, attended to their crews after that. But Peter was lost. Luckily, Ray kept a Mediterranean diary so that I could get a real first-hand or second-hand sense of just how rotten and extraordinarily dangerous it all was. Ray would casually write daily notations like, "Five formations of Stukas attacked at blah 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 time." It was a casual comment through the diary. They often seemed to be in and out of port very quickly, working around the clock, then out to sea on dangerous convoy missions. The British fleet were hard-pressed in those days, and many of their losses were due to no aerial support. How often have we heard that? Every ship was dicing with death against a far superior German aerial assault most days, whether they were in Alex or out of it. Alex was bombarded very often from 4 o'clock on every day. The Mediterranean was something really I knew little about when I began Ray's bio, and I found that Perth's tour there often seems to be in the shadows to her final battle in the Sunda Strait, and by my way of thinking it shouldn't be. The gallant ship fought so bravely in the Med, and in truth few know of it. I was captured by this time as I was by Ray's POW years, or almost as captured. As Ray said when I asked him about the Med and what it had been like, he simply looked at me in his very understated way and said, "It was busy." He was odd, though. He really did get some time, and he made use of it. He managed to paint during this time. He would often get a felucca around and get out into Alex Harbour and paint anything and everything he could. It's quite an extraordinary account of all the old ships and the new ships. His depictions of battles at sea with Stukas dive bombing Allied ships are quite rare. It's quite a rare archive. I think it best then to wrap up what I could say more on the Med with Ray's own words. This diary notation was written on the 28th of May 1941. It was the big day, as 18-year-old A.B. Allen Guthrie, who sadly couldn't be here today, put it. Perth was en route to Alex with an overflowing deck of evacuated soldiers off the beaches of Crete. There were Australians and Maoris and Brits and a very mixed grab bag of very grateful lads. Perth had just been attacked by a flight of Stukas, as usual. Ray was at the wheel taking evasive action on orders from the bridge. The attack subsided and they all thought they might have been through the worst of it, but then there was this one bomb. And this is Ray's quote. "A 500-pound armour-piercing bomb had gone straight through the blacksmith shop, through 4 inches of armoured steel deck, over the boiler room and into it. The whole 8 of the crew had jumped for the exit ladders, 7 up the port ladder. Incredibly, these men managed to pass up and out before the bomb exploded. A man who had taken the starboard ladder was not so lucky. The bomb had cut a superheated steam pipe and he was scalded to death in an instant. The explosion blew up from the boiler room and out onto the deck, blowing off a steel door as it vented. This cut a soldier in two at the chest. Another man lying on a stretch had not a mark at him, but he was just as dead. Others there were killed in shattering ways, and as far as we could eventually count, we thought there were about 13. Cleaning up was a gruesome job for those who had to do it. We had to collect what we could find and then make up what we could of it all. There was some doubt about the actual number because there were not really any bodies, only so many pieces. At dusk, before we entered the harbour at 2100, the dead were passed over the side in burial. The damage from this sortie off Crete made it impossible for Perth to continue, and she was relieved by HMAS Hobart on 5th of July 1941. Apparently talismans and lucky rabbit's feet, even religion, had grown in wide popularity aboard. Such was men's great concern that they were running too close to the wind about getting out of there alive. Men counted their blessings when they heard they were going home. I would like to finish this with Ray's... It's a long piece, but I've cut it down to just one paragraph because I have so much to tell you. But this is really poignant to me. It is not easy to convey how heavy was the strain that the men and ships sustained. More than once I felt that the stage had been reached that no more could be asked of officers and men, physically and mentally exhausted by their efforts and by events of these fateful days. It is perhaps even now not realised how near the breaking point was reached, but that these men struggled through to a measure of their achievement, and I trust that it will not lightly be forgotten. Ray could write. He put it on the page. A battle-scarred Perth returned to Sydney, without fanfare this time, on the 12th of August, 1941. Perth and her crew were a mess, and she needed a big refit. Thelma, Ray's wife, and his two children, Jill and John, came up from Melbourne and were on the decks looking for Ray when the ship came in, mightily relieved, I imagine. Nearing the completion of the refit, someone attempted to sabotage Perth while she was in dry dock, and this turn of events gave Ray the chance to spend his 31st birthday with his family, which didn't happen all that often. That's Thelma. Isn't she gorgeous? Ray was soon very busy, however, as mostly a new crew and a new captain came aboard. Captain Heck Waller took command on the 24th of August 1941. Now, that is a gorgeous photograph that John Waller, who's just published his book on his dad, he found this photograph, and I'd never seen it before, and that's Heck in that little boat. He loved to muck around in boats. Now, I can't remember where it is, but I couldn't but help put it in because it did make me smile. He really just loved boats and ships. Now, he took command on the 21st of October, 1941. Perth's old crew knew Heck well, and they knew he'd been in the Med as the captain of HMAS Stuart. That's Heck with his pipe. He was never much for formalities. He had been captain of HMAS Stuart, which was the flotilla leader of the famous scrap arm flotilla and commander of the Australian 10th destroyer flotilla, basically the same thing. Heck was very experienced and the men were delighted. His reputation was as probably our finest captain was and still is rock solid, and it is shocking he didn't get the VC, and I will say that now. Absolutely shocking. The Perth boys were lucky and they knew it. But with a virtually new crew, there was work to be done for the likes of the experienced POs, Parkin and Coyne. With war to our north looming ever closer and our eyes turned from Europe to our home waters, events and news reports in those months were bad and getting worse. Perth's sister ship, HMAS Sydney, was lost with all hands, and Australia was in mourning. Malaya was invaded, which was too close for comfort. The Prince of Wales and Repulse were sunk, which was simply unbelievable. Pearl Harbour was attacked, which was not possible. Thailand and Hong Kong were lost, all in a matter of a few months. And then came Java. It was now February 1942, and Perth was sent to defend this island. As they left, Ray wrote, as did others aboard, and felt that they really feared for what they were leaving. They were leaving their loved ones at home, and they were frightened about what was coming. As an indication of what Perth was sailing into and the timing, When Perth was already on her way to defend Java, Darwin was being bombed for the first time on the 19th of February. And only days before she reached her destination at Tanjung Priok, which was the port of Batavia, which is now Jakarta, Singapore fell. So the die was thoroughly cast and they were right in the very heart of it. The Battle of the Java Sea followed only 2 days later, and Perth and Houston met there. And they were now under the command of the Dutch. This was a large-scale and lengthy battle against a Japanese invasion force from the east, which was fought above Surabaya in the east. We lost very badly, thanks to the Dutch and their inexperience. But they lost their entire fleet and a couple of British large ships. So by the 28th of February, 28th of February, the only two battleships remaining, only two, were HMAS Perth and USS Houston. Ray's fate was now well and truly sealed, as was everyone on those two ships. Perth and Houston were caught. They had to make a run for it, and they ran through the Sunda Strait with little fuel and less ammo, again thanks to the foolishness and selfishness of the Dutch. And they were given inaccurate intelligence. Therefore, Perth and Houston needed every piece of luck that was left, but none of it was in the offing. The two ships left Tanjung Priok about 7 p.m. on the 28th of February, and by 11 p.m. they had literally run straight into the Japanese Western Invasion Force moored in the Sunda Strait. It was two against an armada. Both ships fought until they had no ammunition, and then they fought some more. Houston was on fire, and Perth had been holed by four torpedoes, as had Houston. It was just past midnight, and Perth and Houston were sinking, and Ray, who had left when abandoned ship was called, watched the third torpedo strike his home and his ship. He watched her final moments from his piece of wreckage, and he wrote this much later in Out of the Smoke. Then the sea was quiet at last, except for a few thin cries from men drowning somewhere in the dark. Men, sometimes almost within touch of each other, were in different worlds. Here a crowd joked profanely, finding comfort in insulting and being insulted by each other. But close to these men, and unknown to them, a man gurgled his last desperate breath as oil fuel entered his lungs and he died, forsaken and alone. Many must have gone like this, badly wounded men clinging to wreckage or floating in their rubber life rafts, trying not to complain. Lightly wounded men sometimes made a great fuss. As descriptions go, and I've read a few about all this, bits and pieces on this, this might just be one of the saddest at the best of what that night might have been like. Perth and her men were gone, and Ray wrote this many years later in his autobiography. We had spent almost half of the whole war actively at sea and had only 17 of our ship's company killed. In just 1 hour, in about as intense as any action can be, out of the 683 aboard that night, almost two out of every three of us were killed. 100 more were to die as prisoners of war. Only 229 were to finally return to their homes. Some of you might notice that those figures are different to what is quoted in the Perth Association and other books. And to be honest, no one really, really quite knows. So I always go by Ray's figures. You can challenge me, please do, but I just stick to what Ray Parkin has written. And he is one of the boys who was there and came home and wrote about it. By the stinking hot morning of 1st of March, Ray and 46 other Perth men, all covered in fuel oil, exhausted, made it to Sangian Island in the Sunda Strait. Thanks to the notes Ray began to keep only 4 days later, we now know who made it ashore to two of those islands. The struggle to make it there would have been Herculean. Thankfully, Ray was a strong swimmer, thanks to the Ivanhoe Sea Scouts, who I know are represented here today. He learned to swim in the river, and he was a good swimmer. But it was simple, dumb luck if you made it to land. I don't believe it was much more, just luck. One of the things Ray said to me about that swim was at one stage he was so exhausted he considered giving in. But then he said to himself, I don't know how to die. How do you die? So he just kept swimming. Some men swam in, others came in on a derelict lifeboat, piloted by the wonderful CPO Horry Abbott, who was a dear friend of Ray, and that's Ray's sketch of him, one of the survivors. Alfie Goyne had survived as well, but Ray knew nothing of it. Alf and others had made it to the other island up the top of the sort of strait. It was called Topper's Island, and they made it in the dark. This bunch of Perth blokes soon realised nothing was going to happen unless they helped themselves, so they cobbled together a raft, left the Americans who wouldn't budge, and made it to Sangean Island, not knowing, of course, that the other Perth survivors were already there. Ray and others had not been lazy, however, as they had found and rigged a derelict ship's lifeboat, and they were going to try for Australia. So a lot of them did. The 10 who eventually took part in this fantastic journey that does rival Bligh's named her Anzac. It made sense to them, you see, as one of them was a New Zealander, Lieutenant John Thode. The others were Harry Mee, Keith Gosden, Horry Abbott, Alfie Coyne, Norm Griffiths, Knocker White, Bogie Knight, Jackie Willis, and of course Ray. After an 11-day sea journey covering about 500 miles, they had had it. They had to surrender to the Japanese in Tillajap on the south coast of Java. And by this stage, it was the 16th of March. They had run out of water and food, and they'd hit the doldrums, and they were becalmed. There was no option. And that's Ray's absolutely sublime, totally sublime watercolour of the Anzac. It fascinates me how beautiful that is. Eventually, Java fell on March 8. Many of the soldiers, airmen and sailors lost their lives while trying to save Java. And sadly, all of those to survive became POWs. The official figures are quite chilling. Over 3,000 Australian servicemen became POWs on Java alone, and 354 were RAN. Of course, they were mostly Perth. Ray and his 9 mates were then POWs, on to their next stage. And soon they were to join Dunlop's 1,000, as they were then called, in a very large POW camp in Bandong, which is where Ray met one of the lifelong, great lifelong friends of his life, Weary Dunlop. The other was Sir Lawrence van der Post. And it has always surprised me that these three rather extraordinary men found themselves meeting in the same POW camp, in the same month, in the same year, in the same war. And there they were three out of thousands. And they were so alike. They were men with amazing and brilliant, talented minds. And yet they were men, all three, who looked after their fellow man. I never did get to meet Weary, sadly. But with all the stuff I know of him, I feel he is a friend. I do. Ray and Weary were great mates, and one of the funny things they used to do in the years after the war was when Weary got a phone call from someone who wanted to talk about his POW years or the Thai Burma, Weary would say, oh, well, yes, you should meet my friend, Mr. Parkin. So basically, Weary would duck shove over to Ray, whoever rang, just to see, you know, it was a filter to see if the inquiry was worth spending the time on. These two were a good doubles act. I have spent the best part of 10 years trying to do a feature or miniseries on Weary, and I kind of feel now that it was not Weary I was meant to discover, that it was Ray. It was Weary who was leading me to Ray, not the other way around. Perhaps Ray was my chore. Who knows? I still don't know. It's hard to say if the core of Ray's life experience on his time was Perth, or on the line, or in Japan. I reckon if I'd have asked him that question, he would have dismissed me rather contemptuously and suggested that all of life was a lesson, and not just the bad or the adventurous bits. Who knows again? But it is safe to say I don't know of any other who came out of all of it with the pictorial and the diarised material, the tangible evidence that Ray had, and we should be so grateful. He painted, drew and wrote whatever he could. Ray's archive is quite remarkable, and it's at the State Library now. He found his first writing material in a coastal Javanese village only 5 days after Perth sank and began recording the events. He didn't stop writing his diaries in various forms until he was sent to Japan, and then he did that in the last few years, just as the war, last few months, just as the war was finishing. And these are the diaries that I have had access to for the first time to write his biography. These are the precious books, as I mentioned a moment ago, and papers now in the State Library. They're called the Parkin Papers. I do urge you to have a look at them. It's quite exceptional. Once again, the specifics of Ray's time as a POW on the Tyburma are large. Ray and the Anzac crew off Perth moved through three POW camps on Java, and then they went through Chang, where they only stayed for 13 days. There they were joined by a small group of other Perth men, and their group was now 13 in number. And they were to become part of what was Dunlop Force with Weary, who were the first to move up to the Tyburma as the first Australians to work in Thailand. So now we're at 25th of January 1943, and we find the 13 Perth men as part of 1,000 other POWs who were put to the task of building Konyu. And this watercolour of Konyu, I jumped for joy when I found this. I've never seen any other depiction except for a pencil outline of where the huts were. So Ray has actually, in painting this, he loved the hill, that's why he did it, nothing else. In painting this depiction at dusk, he's allowed us something of that camp. It was they were to build a camp here and build it out of nothing because there was just jungle. But it's also here that they found out what they were to do, which was to build the 415 kilometres of a railway up to Burma. Hintock soon followed, both the river camp and the horror of the cholera camp at Hintock Mountain. Hellfire Pass, Konyu Cutting, the Pack of Cards Bridge, the Compressor Camp, and all the other horror names from that stretch of the railway. And Ray worked on all of them. But so did many men. What marks Ray out in thousands is the way he did it. He worked on it, all right, but he looked at what was around him as well. He saw the beauty of the jungle and its natural inhabitants. And this adaptation to where he was kept him alive and certainly kept him sane. Ray's way of looking at the world and recording it certainly marks him out in Australia's history and the history of the line. And let's face it, for those who know him, Ray was lucky. He was damn lucky on the line because he survived. However he did it, he survived. Four of the Perth men were in this group of 13, and they were with Ray, and they were what I call the young sailors. And these sailors I want to particularly mark today, and sadly I don't have photographs of them. But when I first met Harry Mee, who was one of the 10 boys on the Anzac lifeboat, and Harry was with Ray through everything, and he was the last survivor of the Anzac. Bless Harry. I love him. When I first met him, Harry was anxious above all things to tell me about these blokes in particular. He called them the young sailors, so I did too. First he wanted me to understand that he hadn't forgotten them, and then he wanted me to not forget them. It was really, really important. But all four lads sadly died on the line, and Harry, when he told me of them, was 91 years of age, and he still felt guilty. He said this: "We couldn't keep them alive. They needed more food, and there wasn't enough." These were the really, it was so sad. I remember it very well when he said those things. But then later, when I was writing Ray's bio, and I was reading into the Smother, which is his book on the Tyburma Railway, I read this. Ray had actually written about them, but not said so. And the line is, "Come back in 1,000 years. Where will the skeletons be?" And it was then that I realised for the first time Ray was writing about Bob Costin, Izzy Herman, Roy Dundon, and I think his favourite lad, Arthur Lund. None were over 21, and they all died in the jungle camps of the line. Ray's diary actually records how each one died, and none of them died well, and mostly of cholera. So if you're up for it, because this is a bit... this gets a bit difficult, really. Here is a piece from Ray's diary about a morning. It's at Hintock Mountain Camp, which was the worst camp for Dunlop Force. It's the beginning of the wet season. And this is Ray's diarised account of a morning, Monday, 31st of May, 1943. Ravelli went in the dark with the drumming of rain on the tent top. the inevitable getting up, water flowing past my 4-inch high bunk and mud inches deep, 2 inches below it. Saturated canvas boots clogged with mud, socks and trouser hanging wet in the rain outside a bamboo. Some lay on and are prepared to go without the breakfast of packed rice and rice tea. I made the decision to sit up, roll up my damp bed and pull it over my drawings where I hope the leaks won't reach. A strip of faint gleam, 15 inches high, is my only indication that outside is not quite so dark as within. I pull on my wet, muddy canvas boots, crawl under the flap, backing and blacking my hands and knees doing it, and straighten up in the rain outside, naked. To the urinal, where others, naked and caked, as personal whim decrees, are similarly standing. I slip on my damp G-string, seize my pail and Dixie, and with grim, concentrated movements, go slowly through the sea of mud, serried chaotically by the feet of moving men coming and going and falling. Here and there a crash, a man is down. If he is lucky, he has not drawn his breakfast. If he has, then he and his breakfast lie together in the mud. Back I crawl on my hands and knees into my bug hole. But getting in is easier than getting out, so my hands, etc., are not so muddy. I have washed the other off well enough on the bamboo bananas, banana leaves, wild and fruitless, just outside. I eat my pap and crawl outside again. But I chucked my socks in before me, having run them out, and now I have my socks on as well as my boots. Outside I find my trousers, wring them out again and put them on. Fall in has sounded. I grab my mess Dixie, spoon and lunch rags, water bottle and hat, and slide down to the parade ground again with the same grim determination that is simply a devout hope that I shall not fall over. Luckily I don't. Then we draw our dinner. As a great queue we advance on the rice bucket and have our Dixies filled with rice, then on to the bucket where scaly fishy fish, that's what he's written, shapeless but strong and salty, is slapped on top of the rice. Then we form up and stand in the rain just as the light of dawn breaks. In 10 minutes, we are out on our way to work. Ray finished this part of his diary by writing, "Sailors are not meant for mud. If it were prevalent everywhere as here, then I'm sure it would constitute the greatest single reason for sending men to sea." At least he had a sense of humour. But then, literally 10 days later, he writes this. By June 21, Ray notes that they had been working for 30 days without a yasmi, a rest day, and the days were 14 hours at a stretch. Ray survived the line. Alfie Coyne did not, as I've said. And Ray was forever angry at his best mate, as that is what he thought. He thought his best mate had given in. Ray had chucked it in, and he wrote of this in his diary. He was angry. His words are shockingly cruel, I think. But true to what he was, Ray even told Alf's son and his wife the truth when he came back. Yet he never got over Alf's loss. He also never forgave him. When Ray wrote his autobiography in the last sort of decade of his life, as an indication of how much he didn't forgive Alf, there's not one mention of Alfie Coyne in that autobiography. Not one word, which amazes me. At the end of the railway, build, Ray was sent to Kinsoyak, which was 170 kilometres up the line from its beginning in Bampong, down in Thailand. It's here Ray wrote, "Of the original O Battalion of 415 men, there are now only 30 of us left." This stubborn, stout-hearted man with disintegrating feet and legs made it to the day he considered he left the line. He left the Thai jungle. And it was the 28th of March, 1944. 13 Perth men had walked into the jungle and only 4 walked out that day. Ray had been on the Thai Burma railway for 14 months. You can see the determination in the eyes, can't you? While writing Ray's biography in my previous book on the Thai Burma, I soon recognised that books take on their own path. They are very organic. Thus, when I realised I had an unintentional list of 7 POWs plus 1 old Japanese man to learn about, I just let it happen. And oddly, this is for me, this part, and oddly, I still live with the images of 3 of these men most days, as their pictures are still on the wall of my office. One is HMAS Perth, PO Alf Coyne. There's no surprise there, I guess. The other is second pioneer Gordon Lindsay Johnson, or Boof. Ray wrote of him as Boof in Ray's final book, which was called The Sword and the Blossom. And finally, is the beautiful pencil sketch that Ray made of the old Japanese schoolmaster who was camp commander at Ray's POW camp in Ohama, the Choko Donna, as Ray named him. And as Ray said, he did what he could. I can't take the pictures down just now, as I feel the history should live just a little while longer in my house. As I have mentioned more than once, Alf died on the line. Boof died only a few short months after his return. His family say that it was because of the brutal beatings he received at the hands of the Japanese jailers in Japan. And the old schoolmaster, the old camp commander in Japan, well, he died only 4 months after the war was finished. It probably strikes you, as it strikes me, that their lives were cut off so cruelly with war. But I'm just not prepared to forget them quite yet. Here I'm reminded of a comment made to me by a widow of a POW. This woman once said to me, "I don't think I'll ever stop weeping." The final piece of Ray's wartime history is in Japan. In late June 1944, he was well enough to be sent on a hell ship over to Japan to mine coal in a derelict mine in Ohama on the main island. The journey took 70 days and they lived through a typhoon. The conditions were beyond even calling it a hell ship. It was a shocker. Three other Perth men were with Ray by this stage. Merchant seaman Les Gosden, and I really don't quite know. I just love this photograph. Excuse me. I suggest that my instinct says he's third from the right. I hope it is anyway. I just love Gosden. He was a merchant seaman, and he and Ray were dear friends all their life. But sadly, their family didn't want to keep all his photographs, so the Parkins have them. Then we have the ever reliable Horry Abbott and the constant Bogie Knight. So there were those Perth men only in Ohama in Japan. They all came home, which is very good. But the winter they spent in 1944 in Japan was utter torture. Of course, it was in Ohama that they starved while they worked a 12-hour shift down an old coal mine, many days with water up past your waist. Ohama is also where the last man to touch me in Ray's story appears. He was Dougie Craig, a 2nd 19th Battalion, young man from West Wyalong in New South Wales. He was murdered by the Japanese in a savage beating in the depths of the terrible winter of 1944, and everyone in camp could hear it and no one could stop it. Ray never met Doug, but he immortalised both Doug and Boof as one person, as his homage to POWs in his final book, in his wartime trilogy, The Sword and the Blossom. Finally, and this is something I hope you find as memorable as I do, finally I would like to show you a map drawn by Ray Parkin out of his book. It denotes the journey of the Anzac lifeboat from Sandian Island on their way home, when they tried to make it home to Australia. The reason for me showing it to you now is that 71 years ago today, at about this hour, the lifeboat carrying 39 Perth men had just reached the Java shore. So if you look right at the top of the map, you'll see the little track over from Sangian Island over to Ajar Lighthouse, or just below it. So they were about there. And about there, and around now, 20 of them on board were deciding to walk to Labuan, which is the next village down the coast, instead of them all remaining in the lifeboat because there were just too many. They were wounded in the boat and there was just no space. So 20 of them decided to walk. And later that day, they would decide who was to stay aboard and who was to sail to Australia and who was to walk basically into certain capture. I think this is probably one of the toughest moments in Ray's story. As Ernie, a sick berth attendant, Ernie Noble, said, "The seaman went to sea," when he described me to me that time, and the others walked in towards the Japanese. I mentioned at the beginning that I would talk about raised talent. I probably haven't managed enough of this, so I would like to finish by letting you decide for yourself with just a shortened list of what this talented man has left us. Ray has left us his account of picking up Perth, the whole journey to Portsmouth and on to New York and the Caribbean, together with his paintings and photos of that journey. His Mediterranean diaries and paintings, his account of the loss of Perth written in Bandung, POW camp in 42, his list of who made it to shore at Sangian and Topaz Island, both US and Australians. And when I found this, I can't tell you, I actually jumped for joy at that one. My tiny list, or his tiny list of pseudonyms from Out of the Smoke, so that for the first time we could actually know what Perth men he was talking about in that book. His amazing Thai Burma diaries and paintings, his personal ship's log of the journey to Japan on the Bokia Maru. It was amazing, that one. His Japan diary and paintings, the books of the trilogy, and a great long monograph of what materials he used to write with as his diaries and how he hid them. I was delighted to have found those. The definitive story about the Anzac sale, which was a constant that no one really knew about that one. And his near to 60 years of correspondence. And I did love reading all of this. And finally, all his artwork, books, and his enormous research into his finale, HMS Bark Endeavour, which I've hardly touched on here. Well, there you are. There's Ray Parkin. I certainly enjoyed the time I spent with him. I never quite knew that I would do his biography. I thought I would do a documentary, which I still may do. But I hope you've enjoyed what I've told you, and thank you all for coming. I would just also like to say thank you to Neil and to Dennis, who's not here today because he's busy with some ministerial thing or other, and to Hayley for having us. I think for those who don't come here very often, it always surprises me because I do come here fairly often for various things, and I'm always delighted at how much of a family this place is. And I know it's meant to be that it was created by families to remember people, but it succeeds, and we should be really proud of it. There's no other place like this in Australia. So I praise the show and all who live in her. Thank you very much.
Wow, what a tremendous talk, and what an amazing talent Mr. Parkin was. Extraordinary work. Now, I would just like to formally thank Paddy on behalf of the Shrine, and also to open up the floor to questions. And Hayley's going to come around with a microphone, so
sorry,
I'll
forgot about questions.
No, that's fine. And so we'll get people, if they want to ask a question, to raise a hand, and Hayley will. Hello, how are you, Mr. Gray?
You're too tall for me. Ah, oh, Rob, what can I do for you?
Who was the gentleman with
Ekwala
in that photograph on the bridge?
Oh, you're a horror, aren't you?
That's an interesting face.
Yes, he does.
I think it was my friend coming in.
Would he be his ex, Mark?
Rose.
I think it was Rose.
I'm being told by you, and it was Lieutenant Commander.
Lieutenant Commander Rhodes.
Do you think Rhodes? Yeah. Rhodes, not Rhodes. I think you're right.
Dusty Rhodes.
Rhodes, because I remember knowing or reading it, but I can't remember. It's got a handsome face, actually.
It's in the
AWM.
Yeah, the history of the RAN, that photo.
Oh, okay. Yes, because there's not many of Heck, sadly.
It's AWM in the
It is AWM. So, sorry, Rob, can't help you, but Rhodes sounds like, and I think I remember it being Rhodes, yeah. Okay,
well,
another curler.
Well, I'm going to ask a question about the. You made mention of the mutiny or alleged mutiny in New York, but you sort of skipped over that. It sounds like there's a story there that many of the people here may be aware of, but I'm certainly not.
Okay. I'll tell you then quickly. When Perth came across the Atlantic to New York, she wasn't set up. She'd just been commissioned. Mm. So the laundries didn't work, and they didn't have much water, and it was really cold. Mm. And Farncombe was a very hard taskmaster. He was not liked. Mm. I have two views of him. But anyway, basically the boys couldn't wash their uniform. So their whites were, as one of the men described to me, they were green. They were horrible. They couldn't put them outside. It was too cold. There was no way to clean them. When they got there, it was stinking hot. It was a burner. It was right in the middle of summer. And Farncombe said, you will go out in your whites. And the boys went, no, not doing that. And he then left the ship. And the 2RC was a guy called Pricky Reed, and they did not like him. And he was as hard a taskmaster as
Pricky Reed.
Anyway, they were English. Farncombe wasn't English. He was Australian. But because our officers were trained by the Royal Navy then, they took on the mannerisms and the accommodations and everything of the Royal Navy.
No,
thank you very much. And Malcolm, who was in the Royal Navy, will probably go for a twistle at that one. But what we had was a brand new crew who hadn't been really to sea before, only a few old salts, and a whole pile of English sailors and officers. And basically all the young ones said, not wearing the whites out, don't want to discredit our ship or the RAN, and they refused to do it. And they gathered together on the foredeck, and they went for it. They actually said, no, we're not going out like this. And all hell broke loose, and it was sorted. But it ended up on Farncombe's service report, and it was also spoken about in Parliament. And all the men that I've spoken to call it an incident. It embarrasses them, right? Because the police did turn up.
Yeah.
But overall, and I've spoken to a couple of people who know more about the Navy than I do, because I do not put myself out as a naval historian at all, they have said to me quite rightly, look, the officers on the way over should have informed the more senior officers that the men were not happy. There were other things that were going on too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was simply a collection. And they got to this heat and they were told to go out in dirty clothes and they went, no, not doing it. They were very foolish. But thankfully nothing really went down. Dear old Pricky Reed, he was blamed. So there you go. Anywhere else?
Down the back.
So it's a bit of a long story to tell you, see.
That's
it is interesting.
I found it very entertaining.
Thank you.
I heard the apocryphal story about in World War I there were two diggers that were leaning against an old truck, and a British officer came by with a monocle and they didn't salute him. And he turned around and said, I say, do you know who I am? And the two Aussies looked one to the other and said, hey, Louis, check out this light up. He doesn't know who he is. We're not far from where the Battle of Young and Jackson took place. In fact, the Battle of Brisbane, I've never heard about this incident. Have you ever thought about doing a book of all these little stories of Australianisms that show the Australian character?
No. In short answer, no, I haven't. Because when you write a book, you starve. I wonder whether I'll do another book after this. But, look, I think you'll probably find there are books about that have collected so many of our stories, because they're wonderful. You're quite right, and the conflict between the Brits and the Australians, World War One to World War Two, it's fantastic stories, just fantastic stories. The Brits should be reminded where they should sit too, by the way.
I remember a couple of years ago when Captain Heckwaller appeared on Australian Story, and Mike Carlton was fighting hard to get a posthumous VC put through.
No, Heck didn't make it out of the Sunda. So who you might be thinking of?
No, they were trying to get a VC award.
Oh yeah, sure.
About
Australian
Story.
Yes.
And you mentioned before that he wasn't given one. Did they give a reason why he wasn't awarded one?
Look, I put in a submission to the Awards Tribunal on behalf of, I'm sure you know these names, Gavin Campbell, Ray Parkin, because I have so many of his papers. I spoke to his family, and Ray left words that could help with him putting a submission in, even posthumously, and also Frank McGovern. So I put in a submission to the tribunal on behalf of three Perth men. So two eyewitnesses. And I was called up to the tribunal here. I sat through 2 days of it because I was absolutely fascinated by what was going on. So I heard maybe 10 submissions by the 13 people who were selected to get VCs. And I walked out just shaking my head, thinking no one will get it. They can't do it. They just can't open up that Pandora's box. And Rob Gray and I have had just last week had some emails about that issue. I just think, what harm would it do, frankly? And I mean, perhaps everyone here will have different views of it. But I don't think it would do that much harm. Teddy Sheehan off the Armidale. My God, what do you have to do to get a VC? My God, he strapped himself onto that ship as it was sinking. We know that he brought down a Japanese plane. We know he did. Men saw it come down. But at that particular day, just to give you a an inkling of how impossible it is for the tribunal to have awarded anyone a VC on that list of 13, one man there was at that tribunal day was a man called Dr. John Leonard, and he was an ordinary sailor on HMAS Armidale. I thought, oh God, great, we've got someone who's an eyewitness for Teddy Sheehan. Fantastic. And he was an officer, he was just a young 18-year-old. But what he did was, when it was abandoned ship, he jumped off one way, couldn't see Teddy firing. He heard Teddy firing. He didn't see him. And then he swam around, joined his mates, and they told him, did you see what Teddy did? They all knew, some of them saw it, but they're all dead now. John, I thought, whoa, with that evidence, no one's going to get a VC. And I did. I actually got cross. Big surprise. But I got cross to the tribunal, and I did. I opened my arms wide, and I said, no one will get one. And it's not fair, because it will not do, it wouldn't do any harm at all. They are brave men, and they should be recognised. So thank you for asking that. Sorry, it gets me a bit cross, this one. Anyone else? No?
I'm going to ask another question then. Are you able to speak any more about Arthur?
Arthur Bancroft?
The friend.
Alfie Coyne.
Alfie Coyne. Are you able to say anything more about that story? Is this sensitive? Particularly about Ray's reaction. You say, I mean, it just sounds like it was such a...
It was terrible.
Such a...
Alf, in the diaries, Alf and Ray met down at Cerberus, and they went through three or four, all the ships that Ray was on, Alfie was on, and they sort of, became POs broadly at the same time, you know, all that sort of stuff. So they were peers. When Ray and Alf got up to Konyu, which was their very first camp on the line, which they had to build, that was the Pink Mountain camp. It was just jungle, so they had to build a camp, build the road up to the line, and then when that was done, they had to start the railway, which was already under construction. And Ray notes that Alfie's just off colour, and he starts to say that there. And in Ray's biography, which I should show you so you all buy it outside, in Ray's biography, I've said you can't really tell from the diaries where Alfie decided that he was going to give in. And I can't contradict, I wouldn't contradict Ray, but Alfie, I know Alf's son very well, and I spoke to him about what I was going to write and what was in the diaries, and he said, no, I know, and I would like, I've not read the diary, so I would like to see it and to have it published. He just said to me that Alf had such a bad life as a child, because his mother, he was a boy from Harcourt, and he was one of three boys, and his mum died really early, and so they put, the dad put Alf and his two sons into a home, I think it was the Burwood Boys Home, you know, in like 1912 or something, 1910. And they were there for a few years, and then the dad came and got the two boys out and left Alf. And so, and I met Alf's wife, Phyllis, who was gorgeous. I was very lucky to meet people who were still alive to sort of back up these stories. But Alfie was left. So no one loved Alfie. And as his son said, he'd had such a bad time, unlike Ray, who had come from a family that had loved him. He had a wife that loved him. He had two children. Alf didn't have that, really. He got married, you know, that was fine. But he was a wicked one, Alf. But when it came to doing it again and surviving again, he didn't have it in him. That's what we reckon. And from Konyu, from the Pink Mountain on, what Alf figured was that if he pulled a sickie, he could go into hospital. And hospital was a tent. It was nothing. And an awful lot of men on the line say, what you never did was go into hospital. You know, there are men I've met who said, I was never on sick parade once. And they might have been dying with four things. But you didn't go into the hospital tent. Because it gave them a reason to stop. And that's what happened to Alf, we think. He literally, He tried to buck the system by being smarter than the system. Of course, he went down and down and down and down and down. And then right at the end, I urge you to read that part in the book. You can steal it out in the shelves out there. You don't have to buy it. And right at the end, they all congregate in Tamiwan. When the railway was done, they were all the men who survived were brought back to this really large camp in Tamiwan. And that's where all the Perth survivors, what was left, came together. And one night, oh God, it brings tears to my eyes. They all sat in this one long hut with a little sort of slushy lamp. And they exchanged stories about who died and how the boys died. And that, I almost didn't put it in the book. And my husband often says to me, you must tell the stories. And he's quite right. I must tell the stories, as hard as they are. But there were two men who looked after Alf right at the end. One's called Sailor, would you believe? And no one knows who Sailor is, but Alf was in another camp, and these two men cleaned him up, bought him water, and he died. It's very sad. So, I hope that answers it. Anyway, he touches my heart. Oh, Alf does. That's it. Ah, you again. Sure, I can't write that book, by the way.
Thank you. I might give someone else a chance to ask a question. But you mentioned Lawrence van der Post.
Mm.
Is that the South African that wrote about the Kalahari Bushmen? And
yes.
Could you tell us a bit about him? Indeed.
Lawrence is fantastic. He's the most interesting character. And it does fascinate me that Weary and Ray and Lawrence all ended up in Bandung. They spent about 8 months together. And they literally went like, you know, bees to a hive. They recognised one another. Lawrence was, he was a backroom boy, really. He was a spy, let's face it. He was sent to Java to try and get people out and to send intelligence back. But he was caught, he was betrayed, he was tortured, and he ended up in Bandung only days, really, before Ray arrived. And, of course, they recognised one another. The intellect just shone out of the three of them. And what happened was, when Ray arrived and they all started to, you know, become friends... Ray had already begun to write about the sinking of Perth, and what had happened in Java is that the Japanese had given them all, God knows why, the foolscap sheets of what the boys call toilet paper. Now, I don't know if they were toilet paper, but they were really, really slim. It's tissue paper. And Ray got it and started to write his story of Perth. And Lawrence realised that Ray was no dud and he could write, and as Ray says in his diary, he used to go to Lawrence, he'd write a bit, and he'd go to him and he'd show it to him and they'd discuss how it was going. And that gorgeous document is in the library here. It's called Finney. It's amazing. And beautiful Lawrence turned around and said to Ray, when we get out of this, not if we get out of this, when we get out of this, send me your manuscript and I'll get it to my publisher. Now, his publisher turned out to be Leonard Woolf, Virginia and Leonard Woolf and Hogarth Press. Ray Parkin, I think, I can't prove it, but I think is the only Australian to be published by Hogarth Press. You know, he's in the same publishing house as Freud and Vita Sackville West and amazing, amazing names. And Ray was a worker on the wharves when he was having those books published. Extraordinary. But what was terribly sad was when Weary left, Weary took his bunch of 1,000 men out of Bandung and they were sent to Changi. And in Lawrence's diaries, or his book, his biography, he actually writes that they went to the gate to say goodbye to their friends. And they all knew that they were losing the strength of the camp, because Weary was their strength. And then Lawrence writes that after that, the whole... Because it wasn't a bad camp, it was actually quite okay, the camps went, it was good accommodation... Not much food at all, but the Japanese didn't bother them that much, and, you know, it was okay. But when Weary left, the camp declined terribly, and the food was nothing. And then the Koreans came in, and the Koreans were really brutal. And you couldn't get away from them, you couldn't understand why they did it, but they really took to the men. And Lawrence wrote that he actually believed that they would all die in this camp. And he wrote a diary, and he put his address in it in London, and he buried it, thinking he'd die. And unbeknownst to him in Indonesia, you know, when the independence thing after the war started, someone dug it up, and it was a man known to Lawrence, and he posted back his diary. Unbelievable, you know. So he was then able to get this gorgeous you know, thing that he'd kept and you know, cobbled together. They were dear friends. And then, to finish it off, this is a funny little thing. In 1946, because Lawrence didn't go home, he stayed to try and keep, you know, the Dutch East Indies as the Dutch East Indies, of course. You know, he was, you know, he was again being a bit of a spy. And he didn't go home when everyone else went home. And in about 1946, he was going through Melbourne Airport. He bumped into Weary, literally. And they went, oh, I know you. And they swapped addresses. And then, of course, Weary gave Lawrence Ray's address, and they were able to connect again. And I don't know if you noticed, but right at the end of my little speech here, I said, Ray has 60 years of correspondence. The most fascinating part of that are 50-odd years of correspondence twice a year with Lawrence Anderpost. The letters are breathtaking. They're impossible to... I haven't read every page, but Ray used Lawrence Anderpost as a mentor very often. And they talked about philosophy, and it went a lot over my head. But it was fascinating. And it's all in our library. So, here's an interesting chap. I'll stop talking.
Yeah, and I'm afraid I have to end the questions there. But we've got some morning tea and some biscuits, Anzac biscuits out. And I'm sure that Paddy will be happy to answer any questions that you might have and to sign copies of the book, which will be at the bookshop.
Right,
once again, can everyone please just put their hands together? I mean, that's just one of the best talks we've had for a really long time.